Their response was a barrage of plasma missiles. 10. From Mako to Jake Pentecost. No subject. Attachment 899H25GSS24.jpg. Transmitting. Transmission interrupted. Retry Y/N. Y. Transmitting. Transmission interrupted. Retry Y/N. Y. Marshal Kwan's voice cut through the chatter coming from the Losant. Missiles fired! Multiple ordnance inbound! The first salvo of missiles annihilated the anti-kaiju cannons. Jake just had time to think that the Jaeger had been pausing to target each of them, planning how it was going to engage, when a tight following barrage slammed into Gypsy Avenger. Other missiles streaked past, and the facade of the PPDC Council building disappeared in a cluster of explosions. Multiple impacts rocked Gypsy Avenger. Alarms wailed, some inside the con pod and some coming through the comms from the Losant. Jake fought a rising sensation of panic. He was a simulation cowboy, unbeatable in VR exercises, but he had never been in combat. Time seemed to slow around him, and his sense of his surroundings started to fade. There were voices in his head. Lambert was shouting, but the voice that penetrated into Jake's struggling mind was Stacker Pentecost's. "You don't belong in a Jaeger," he said. Jake felt himself falling back into his memories, the rabbit hole that was an ever-present danger in the drift. "Jake, stay connected, Jake!" Lambert's voice. But Jake was already gone. Gypsy Avenger staggered and started to lose her balance as he fell back into the past, inexorably drawn by the sound of his father's voice. "Jake!" Lambert was shouting. Alarms wailed as another volley of plasma missiles nearly knocked Gypsy Avenger off her feet. "Pentecost!" Jake snapped out of the memory, climbing up out of the rabbit hole with the tears of his 15-year-old self still hot on his face. Still disoriented, he tried to get a handle on what was going on. What do we do? "Stay focused, follow my lead, and look out!" A house-sized piece of the council building, destabilized by missile impacts, toppled off the front toward the crowd below. Trapped by the crush of people trying to get away from the hostile Jaeger, the people in its path could do nothing but scream. In the con pod, Lambert shot out one hand. Gypsy Avenger caught the chunk scant feet above the heads of the crowd. Just outside the shadow of Gypsy's arm, Chief Kang and the security detail hustled Xiao Lian back into the limousine. It gunned its engine, nosing through the crowd toward the vacant spaces near the street. More missiles crashed into Gypsy Avenger. They weren't penetrating her armor yet, but external systems were taking damage, and the kinetic impacts kept Gypsy off balance. "We're losing power!" Jake shouted as alerts flashed across the system's monitoring screen. The missiles were doing damage even if they weren't getting through Gypsy's armor. "Rerouting systems," Lambert said. He worked the holoscreen on his side of the cradle. "Jake!" Mako's voice was splintered by static. "That Jaeger's power reading is the same as..." In a flare of white noise, her voice cut out. Jake saw readings on the monitors that told him the Jaeger was jamming comms. Someone had planned this attack for this moment, right when Xiao was about to announce the end of piloted Jaegers, right when she and all the PPDC administrators would be in one place. Jake wondered who. Kaiju nuts? Some terrorist group that had gotten hold of Jaeger tech? How could that have happened? He looked in the direction of Mako's helicopter, and in his field of view saw the strange Jaeger raising and powering up what looked like a particle cannon aimed at the helicopter. "Nate," he said, his voice high and tight with fear. Thanks to the drift, Nate understood instantly. "Power's up," he said. And in the next instant, Jake threw the chunk of the council building across the plaza at the hostile Jaeger. Debris showered down over the crowd as the multi-ton chunk of concrete and steel smashed into the hostile Jaeger, knocking it off balance and ruining its aim at Mako's chopper. Jake and Lambert sprang forward in the cradle, and Gypsy Avenger charged toward the Jaeger, barreling into it and trying to grapple. But the black Jaeger was quicker than they had expected. It shook Gypsy off and raked her armor with claws. Gypsy reeled back into a building, shattering its front walls and windows. She planted her feet, narrowly avoiding the crowds of fleeing people in the street below. That moment of inattention to the hostile Jaeger cost them. It caught Gypsy Avenger by one leg and smashed her into another building, driving her down to the street in a pile of collapsing rubble. Then the black Jaeger sprang onto Gypsy and sank claws into the armor around the con pod, trying to rip her head off. Inside the con pod, Jake wrestled against the Jaeger's grip. Lambert punched commands into the holopad projected from the forearm of his drive suit. Gypsy Avenger's chainsword cut out from her forearm, forcing the hostile Jaeger to let go. Pivoting as she got to her feet, Gypsy swung, but the other Jaeger was too fast, much faster than any other Jaeger they'd ever seen. It dodged the sword stroke and kicked Gypsy into another building. The street was treacherous footing now, with collapsed facades and destroyed cars littering the pavement. Answering Gypsy Avenger's chainsword, the other Jaeger flexed its arms and twin plasma weapons sprang from its forearm mounts. At first, Jake thought they were swords, but then he saw the edges start to spin. Chainsaws. It had plasma chainsaws. They barely got their own chainsword up to block the first strikes in a shower of sparks and discharged plasma. Arcs of energy shattered nearby windows and scorched buildings. The hostile Jaeger cut loose with a wild swing that nearly split an office tower down the middle from roof to atrium. Gypsy stepped back, looking for another opening to attack, but both Jake and Lambert knew they were up against an opponent that was faster than they were. If they went in recklessly, they were going to end up in pieces. The other Jaeger dropped into a fighting posture and came at them again. Mako's pilot was turning the chopper in wide circles, looking for a safe place to land. "We need to land," he shouted. "No!" Mako wasn't going to leave Jake alone to fight this thing. Gypsy Avenger was clearly overmatched, even if she knew Jake and Lambert would never admit that. They would go down fighting. "We have to help them. Target that Jaeger." The pilot complied, but she could see on his face he didn't think it was a good idea. "Target locked," he said. Mako's eyes narrowed. This was her brother's life on the line. "Fire!" Jake and Lambert were pushed to the limit of their abilities, countering the foreign Jaeger's attacks. It was faster than any Jaeger they had ever seen, and so quick on its feet that they felt like they were in an old Mark I trying to tackle a Mark V. Jake was getting into the rhythm of operating Gypsy Avenger again after so many years, and he felt his drift connection with Nate getting more solid as they worked together. But it wasn't enough. The hostile Jaeger scored hits on Gypsy's torso and shoulders. If they couldn't find a way to anticipate its technique, sooner or later it would land a fatal blow with a plasma chainsaws. Pressed back by a fresh assault, Gypsy sidestepped to avoid a crowd of people trapped by a cascade of rubble from a nearby office building. The other Jaeger took advantage, rearing up for a downward stroke before Jake and Lambert could get Gypsy's chainsword up. But as the plasma weapon arced down, a barrage of missiles from Mako's helicopter detonated on the hostile Jaeger's arm and head, deflecting its stroke. Missing Gypsy Avenger by scant feet, the plasma saw chewed through several floors of another building. It jammed against something in the building's interior, and the Rangers saw their chance. Gypsy Avenger pounced, using the time Mako had bought them to power up another of Gypsy Avenger's combat abilities. The Jaeger's right arm had a force-multiplying rocket piston assembly designed to accelerate the velocity of a thrown punch. The rockets fired at the moment before impact, turning an ordinary punch into a supersonic impact that in testing had destroyed older model dummy Jaegers with a single blow. This opponent was tougher than a practice dummy, though. The punch connected with an echoing boom that blew out nearby windows and sent the hostile Jaeger flying down the broad avenue. It slowed itself down by thrusting the plasma saws out to either side, using them to drag itself to a halt as they gouged several blocks of office towers. Immediately, it had arrested its slide. The other Jaeger unleashed a fresh missile salvo. Some of the missiles hit Gypsy Avenger, but most streaked by and exploded across a large expanse of Sydney's downtown. Civilians who thought they were safely away from the battle fled anew as the missiles collapsed buildings and parking structures. One of the missiles hit high on a skyscraper near Mako's helicopter. The blast wave jolted the chopper, cracking its fuselage windows and sending it into a crazed spiral. Electrical fires sparked to life in the cockpit. Jake saw Mako's helicopter dropping, its tail spinning around as it lost control. "She's going down. We need to move." Lambert was right with him. "Activating gravity sling," he called back. Gypsy Avenger's right hand reconfigured itself into a force-projecting assembly that could manipulate gravity in its limited cone. The gravity sling swept up a cascade of falling cars from a collapsing parking garage and whipped them in a single mass at the hostile Jaeger. The force of the impact punched it over backward into an uncontrolled tumble. Before it had even hit the ground, Jake and Lambert had Gypsy sprinting across the distance between them and Mako's spiraling helicopter. Jake tried to get the gravity sling to redeploy and catch the chopper, but it wasn't responding after its initial use. "Come on!" he shouted, straining in the drift cradle, pushing Gypsy Avenger to maximum speed. He and Lambert leaned forward as one, and Gypsy Avenger dove forward, covering hundreds of yards in the air, hand outstretched to catch the falling helicopter. Through the Conpod window, Jake saw Mako frantically tapping something into her datapad. She looked up at their approach, putting a hand flat on the inside of her window as the helicopter scraped off Gypsy Avenger's fingertips. Jake was screaming, maybe just in his mind, as the chopper spun down at an angle and smashed into the pavement below. It tumbled, shedding broken rotors and pieces of its fuselage, crashing off parked cars, and finally rolling to a halt in a smoking ruin. A moment later, Gypsy Avenger smashed down from her desperate leap, the impact bouncing debris up into the air and shattering nearby windows. Glass was still showering down as Jake disengaged himself from the drift cradle and threw open the hatch on the side of Gypsy Avenger's head. "Jake! Wait, Jake!" Lambert called after him. But in that moment, Jake didn't care about the hostile Jaeger, or Sydney, or the PPDC. All he cared about was his sister. He ripped off his helmet and sprinted the stretched-out length of Gypsy Avenger toward the wreckage of the helicopter. He knew what he was going to find. He'd seen the impact, and he knew no human being could have survived it. But he wasn't going to believe it until he called for his sister, and she did not answer. Far behind him, the rogue Jaeger started to approach Gypsy Avenger. Then it paused. Coming in from the north, a formation of Jump Hawks was bringing three Jaeger reinforcements. The Jaeger watched them, seeming to assess its odds. Then it turned around, moving fast and low back toward the harbor. By the time the Jump Hawks were close enough to drop the reinforcements, it was gone beneath the waters. 11. We who have seen the divine truth celebrate this glorious strike against the heretics of the Pan-Pacific Defense Corps and their mechanical forces of darkness. The would-be dictators of the PPDC Council have paid the ultimate price for their heresy, and the power of the Antiverse is on the rise. Sydney chose its fate, failing to learn the lessons of Mutavore when it consented to be the site of the Council Citadel. Our forces have struck a decisive blow against the unbelievers. We rejoice in the destruction of those who would hide the true nature of God and rebel against the kaiju who are its truest evidence. We will continue our crusade against the forces of blind humanist arrogance. We call on all humanity to repent of its sins, acknowledge the divine nature of the kaiju messengers of God, and humbly pray that the breach will open again, showing us the way to paradise. In the name of God and his kaiju messengers, we who have seen. Jake had been back in Moylan for less than an hour after debriefing on the flight, and then sitting through a short after-action follow-up session with Marshal Kwan. Then they had let him go, sensing that he needed some time to grapple with his personal loss before he would be able to help them figure out where Obsidian Fury, the rogue Jaeger, had come from, and who might have created it. He had wandered through the halls, not meeting anyone's eyes, until he found himself in the so-called Hall of Heroes. A plaque on the wall read, "In honor of those who gave their lives in the service of their world." Beyond it, lining both sides of the corridor, were digital memorials to fallen Rangers. The Beckett brothers, Yancey and Raleigh, Chuck Hansen, the Wei Tang triplets, Sasha and Alexis Kaidanovsky. Jake was standing in front of the memorial to his father. On the screen, Stacker Pentecost stood in full martial dress uniform, looking sternly out at his prodigal son, at last returned to his ranger duties. Just past Stacker Pentecost was a new memorial. Jake hadn't expected there to be one so quickly, but there it was. Mako Mori, Secretary General and former ranger in full uniform, beaming out from the screen next to her adoptive father. The floor near Mako's memorial was piled with flowers and candles, little tokens and handwritten testimonial notes. The whole Shatterdome mourned the loss of one of its own. "I'm the only one left," Jake thought. "The whole family is gone now except for me." He stepped up to Mako's memorial screen and addressed her. "I'll hit him back for you, Mako." Then he taped a photograph to the edge of the screen. It showed Stacker, improbably smiling, his arms draped around Jake and Mako when they were. Jake couldn't remember exactly. Young, anyway. Before Jake and his father had really started to butt heads, before everything had gone wrong. Now it was too late to ever set any of it right. 12. PPDC Secretary General Mori killed in rogue Jaeger attack. Wire service reports. Among the dead in today's rogue Jaeger assault on the meeting of the Pan-Pacific Defense Corps Council was the PPD Secretary General Mako Mori. Mori was en route to the meeting when her helicopter was downed by a missile from the rogue Jaeger, which has already acquired the moniker Obsidian Fury. The PPDC did not immediately confirm Mori's death, despite multiple sources corroborating the initial report. Before becoming Secretary General, Mori was a ranger who co-piloted Gypsy Danger's final mission to close the breach in 2025. Both she and Raleigh Beckett, the other ranger on that mission, survived, though Beckett would later succumb to a rare cancer. Mori's adoptive father, PPDC Marshal Stacker Pentecost, died during the mission. Her career as a ranger was nearly ended before it began due to Pentecost's opposition, but she persevered and rose to the top of the Corps before moving into her council role. She is survived by her brother Jake Pentecost, formerly a PPDC cadet who was last seen in the slums of Santa Monica, California. Attempts to locate him have been unsuccessful. Someone was yelling behind one of the doors just down the hall, the sound muffled behind the closed door, but unmistakably angry. Jake walked in that direction, remembering that cadet drift training used to be located in this wing. And sure enough, the noise was coming from a door labeled Drift Training, Cadet Level 1. What they used to call drifting for dummies. More yelling came from inside. Jake walked in and saw Amara sitting at a training rig. A computer voice said, "Neural connection failed." Amara threw a punch at a hollow screen representing her drift pattern, her fist passing through it as she noticed Jake. She dropped her hand and looked embarrassed, which made Jake feel embarrassed. Then after a prolonged pause, Amara said, "So I'm not great with feelings, but sorry about your sister." "Half-sister?" "Her parents died in the Onababa attack," Jake said. "My dad took her in. She was my sister. My family." Amara wasn't sure how to handle the emotional weight of what Jake was dropping on her, so she went with her tried and true strategy, making a joke out of it. "Better not let Ranger Lambert see you out of uniform. He'll take the stick out of his butt and beat you with it." He couldn't help but smile. She was trying, and that wasn't bad considering her normal interpersonal settings ranged from scorn to stony silence. "Think I'm safe. It's wedged in there pretty tight." Coming closer, Jake checked out the drift rig Amara had been beating on. He couldn't help but grin when he saw that one side was wired to a tank containing a human brain, suspended in a tank of synthetic cerebrospinal fluid. On the base of the tank was a plaque Jake knew by heart. "This is Sarah. She donated her mind so that you could train. Tell me her favorite candy bar." "They're still using Sarah, huh?" Jake remembered the hours he'd spent learning to drift with her. It almost made him feel sentimental. "I can't get her to drift with me," Amara said, her voice part growl and part whine. "The other cadets have been training forever. I hate feeling like the slow kid." "You gotta relax, you're just grinding gears," Jake said. It was a lesson he'd learned again that day, and that thought started to lift his mood. He could maybe do some good here on a day that had been so terrible so far. Leaning in, he punched a series of hollow commands. Sarah retracted, and a regular drift rig appeared to take her place. "Relax," Amara said, back to her normal sardonic self. "Got it, coach." "Don't call me coach," Jake said. "Sensei?" Jake slid the practice helmet on. "Just clear your mind. Can't connect if you're running your mouth. You ready?" Nervous, but trying not to show it, Amara gave him a double thumbs up. "Let's see if we're drift compatible." Jake tapped in a fresh series of commands. The drift rigs connected, and Jake felt the psychic rush of entering a drift with another human mind. Amara felt it too, more powerfully than Jake did because she was so new to the experience. She gasped out loud, and the two of them fell into the melding intercognitive non-space of the drift, their memories jumbling and pouring over each other. Amara is a young girl, chasing her brother across their backyard. They're laughing, and as they pass her parents, they smile and lean into each other a little, feeling the simple joy of happy children and a life together. Amara on her bicycle, a birthday gift. She'd just been to the store with her mother, and as a reward for good behavior, she got noisemakers to put on the spokes. She pedals faster and faster as the slapping sound of the noisemakers becomes a whir. Amara in the garage with her father. A car engine, partially disassembled, hangs from a block and tackle. He is showing her how the pistons work in the cylinders. On a workbench next to the block and tackle, the engine's head sits drying after they've just cleaned it. Once it's dry, they'll set the head gasket and put it back on, and after that they're going to drop it into a car. Jake, 8 years old in his father's study. Stacker is at the Shattered Dome inspecting the Jaegers. Jake picks up different things on his father's desk, a pen, a folder containing cross-section blueprints of machine parts he doesn't understand. Next he finds his father's Marshall hat hanging on a coat rack behind the desk. He takes it off its peg and puts it on. It's way too big, covering his eyes. He tips it back so he can see and catches a glimpse of his reflection in the study mirror. His father is an important man doing important things. Jake knows this. One day he's going to be like his father. He salutes, feeling big and important himself. Jake in cadet training, jogging alongside Nate Lambert. They're both teenagers, filled with grand ideas and ambitions. At night after training, they walk about saving the world, being the first line of defense if the kaiju ever return. The run is punishing, mile after mile in the hills outside the Shatter Dome. But if it meant getting into a Jaeger, Jake would run to the moon and back. He is Stacker Pentecost's son. Nothing is going to stop him from being worthy of his father's example. In the combat training room, Mako comes at Jake with a staff. He tries to parry, but she slips his defense and her staff taps him along the ribs. She backs away and shows him what she did, teaching him what to look for, little shifts in the opponent's way to the direction of her gaze. They do it again. He comes closer, but she still gets through. They reset. She's telling him he can do this, but he's going to have to focus, block everything else out except this moment, only this moment. Warning, neural connection unstable. Jake snapped out of the drift fugue and saw the drift connection meter on the training rig's monitor. The strength of their connection was dropping, close to the red zone where it would break apart and they would have to start all over again. "Stay focused," he said, channeling what Mako had said to him so long ago. He felt her renewed concentration, the revitalized clarity of her thoughts and her presence in the drift. "That's it," he encouraged. "The stronger the connection, the better you fight." She grinned, and Jake felt a rush of her happiness as she felt herself getting the hang of the drift. "This isn't so hard," she said. "You lived in a mansion?" Then a memory struck her, and Jake felt her shock. She's on the Santa Monica Pier. The sun is shining, but a long shadow falls over part of the boardwalk. She holds a Polaroid picture in one hand. All around her, people are running and screaming. There's a noise, like nothing she's ever heard, and a smell cuts through the seaside odors of salt and caramel corn and grill smoke. "Don't let a memory pull you in. Let them pass through you. Amara!" Jake's voice. She turned to see him, but instead, her father, smiling, holding a Polaroid camera. "Amara, get in there," he says, pointing to where her mother and brother are already at the pier railing. They press close together and her father raises the camera. Click. The Polaroid photo slides out of the camera. Amara rushes to her father and takes it from the camera, then dashes back to the railing. She shakes the photo, enchanted as always by the way the picture slowly comes into being from the uniform gray of the exposed film. She starts to see the shapes of their bodies, then their faces against the endless expanse of the Pacific Ocean. "Amara, you need to let it go." There's a sound like an earthquake and a kaiju, insurrector, rears up from the water. Waves surge outward from it, battering the pier's piling. The pier shakes and the kaiju crushes an entire section, which tumbles into the water. The air fills with screams and Amara freezes, Polaroid in her hand. Her mother and father and brother are on the other side of the shattered gap in the boards. "Warning, pilot exceeding neural limits." "Amara!" It's Jake's voice, but also her father's voice. He stretches a hand out across the gap. The kaiju looms, its roars loud enough to shake the pier under her feet. "You have to jump!" Amara hesitates, terrified of the churning water below. Please, baby, jump to me. I'll catch you, I promise. Amara! She runs and leaps with all the strength she can muster, but just as her feet leave the boards, the kaiju's foot comes down, obliterating the pier in front of her and everyone on it. Her father is gone in that instant, and her mother and brother and hundreds of other people. Her hands grasp empty space and she plummets into the water. Eyes wide with shock, she registers the shadow of the kaiju passing overhead and feels the pull of its gargantuan step. The water churns around her and her chest begins to burn. She can swim a little, but only on the surface and only with a wacky noodle. She kicks and flails her arms, but the surface of the water still seems far away. Light ripples around her again, but she's sinking down among the shattered timbers and the dark floating shapes she will not think about. Someone grabs her by the shoulder. Amara, come on, hey! It's Jake. She's not in Santa Monica. She's not 4 years old. She's in the drift training room of the Moyolin Shatter Dome, and she's 15. But it was all just right there. It was real.
I was back home, she said. I felt it.
She was shaking, trying not to panic, and also feeling the first waves of embarrassment and shame at Jake seeing her so vulnerable. She looked up at him and saw the sympathy in his face. I felt it too, he said. Was the drift always like that? Did you have to let your partner all the way into your head to see everything you'd ever been afraid of or sad about, every weakness behind the brave front you put up so the world wouldn't look too closely? Jake's calm crackled. Jake, it's Nate. You there? Still looking at Amara, Jake found his calm. Yeah, I'm here. Meet me in the lab right away. Marsha wants to see us, and lose the robe. Check, Jake said, rolling his eyes for Amara's benefit. No robe. Already she was feeling better. She wasn't going to be afraid. She wasn't going to let that stop her. This was her chance.
I want to try again, she said.
Jake's voice was surprisingly gentle. That's enough for one night, he said.
I thought you were going to help me,
Amara said. She almost took a shot at him about wearing his dad's hat and saluting like a little boy soldier, but with an effort she stopped herself. As much as she hated to admit it, this wasn't a time to resort to her typical social strategy of acerbic bravado. So instead she went for a flippant remark that she hoped would tell Jake how much this meant to her.
I didn't even figure out what Sarah's favorite candy bar is.
It's an Almond Joy, he said.
That's not helping, that's cheating, you dick.
On his way out the door, Jake couldn't help but smile. When he was gone, Amara sat looking at the drift rig again. Already she felt wrung out, but she wasn't going to give up now. After all, she'd already relived the worst moment of her life, and with Jake Pentecost right there in her head, what could the drift do to her now? She swiped at the holo terminal, and Sarah the brain slid back into position. Amara shook her hair back and put the practice helmet back on.
Okay, Sarah, she said. What else do you like besides candy?
She stabbed a final command and initiated the drift again. 13. Editorial. I hate it when I'm right. The dead are still being counted in Sydney thanks to a still unidentified rogue Jaeger attacking the Pan-Pacific Defense Corps for reasons nobody seems to be able to figure out. Don't believe the kaiju nuts who claimed the attack. Even if they could build a Jaeger, why would they attack when another Jaeger was there to fight back? Terrorists don't like an even fight. They would have sent that Jaeger out to massacre innocent people or maybe gone after the council at one of its meetings when Gypsy Avenger wasn't there to fight back. Right? It doesn't make any sense. The real problem here is that the PPDC doesn't know where this Jaeger came from. You saw what happened. That thing kicked Gypsy Avenger's ass, and if it had wanted to, it could have put her down and then done whatever it wanted with the rest of Sydney. So why didn't it? What does that tell you? I know what it tells me. Someone out there has tech that equals anything the PPDC can put into the field, and we don't know who they are. That ought to scare you a lot more than a bunch of kaiju nuts trying to claim something they obviously didn't do. Jake asked Lambert what was up when they headed for the K-Science wing of the Shatter Dome, but Nate didn't want to get into it. Better you see for yourself, he said. I'm going to let Gottlieb tell you. When they got to the lab, Gottlieb was squinting at a holoscreen that showed a fragmented swirl of color and numbers.
Marshal Kwan was there observing. He looked up and nodded as Jake and Lambert came in. Jake looked at the screen, unsure why Gottlieb would have wanted him to see it. "What is it?" he asked. "A message," Kwan said, "from Mako." This hit Jake hard, bringing back that last image he had of her, palms pressed against the chopper window as it slid away from Gypsy Avenger. He blinked and tried to keep his attention on the here and now. "She was trying to send it from her copter right before she..." Gottlieb cut himself. He looked at Jake, unsure how to go on, then cleared his throat and stuck to the facts. "It's a data packet, high density." "Obsidian Fury was jamming comms," Lambert said. "Outer signal get through." "It didn't," Kwan said. "At least not intact." "So it's gone?" Jake said. What was he doing here, then? Gottlieb was still squinting, but now he was also running another program in parallel with a fractal swirl of data. "Gone is relative in the digital realm," he said as he tweaked the program he had up on the parallel screen. "By running a modified fractal algorithm, I might be able to reconstruct a few megabytes." Code unspooled on the screen. Gottlieb muttered to himself. Jake got restless, standing there watching a scientist wrestle with data, while he wondered if there was going to be a last note from his sister, or not. He wished they'd figured out if they could salvage anything before they brought him here. Now that he knew the message existed, if Gottlieb couldn't unscramble it, Jake would spend the rest of his life wondering what it said. "There," Gottlieb said. The image on the main holo screen coalesced and resolved. There was still static, but... Is that a kaiju? Jake wondered aloud. It sure looked like one. Sketchy and unfamiliar, but definitely a kaiju head. Gottlieb worked his terminal, running pattern recognition software on the image, sorting through known kaiju. "No match against the database." "Maybe it's a symbol," Lambert suggested. "Something connected to the kaiju cults." Now Gottlieb ran a search on all symbols, icons, and patterns related to the branch of kaiju worshippers. "No match," Gottlieb said again. "Keep looking," Marshal Kwan ordered. "Whatever this is, it was important to her. I want to know why." He left, presumably to brief PPDC intel on the existence of the drawing to see if that could help pin down the origin of the rogue Jaeger they were calling Obsidian Fury. Lambert was still looking at the drawing. "You don't stop fighting till the enemy's down," he said. Then glancing over at Jake, he added, "If you're really a soldier." With that, he followed Kwan out. Jake couldn't take his eyes off the holoscreen. This drawing was the last thing his sister had ever made. She had known what was going to happen to her, and she had wanted him to see it. Why? The question preoccupied him long after he'd left the lab. Mako had known she was going to die when the chopper was going down. She wouldn't have expected Gypsy Avenger to save her. Actually, trying to save her had been a stupid idea, Jake thought. It was never going to work, and it took Gypsy away from the main objective, stopping Obsidian Fury. The rogue Jaeger had slunk away into the ocean when it saw reinforcements coming, but Jake couldn't help but think he might have been able to find a hole in its technique if they'd been able to analyze it a little longer. Gypsy had taken a beating, that was for sure. Techs were working her over in the Shattered Dome right now. But Jake had learned a long time ago that sometimes you had to take a punch to give one, so you had to make sure your punches counted when you got the chance to throw them. Now he was spoiling for the chance to meet Obsidian Fury again and land that final punch. But the truth was, they'd never seen anything like that speed and fluidity in a Jaeger. There had been other Jaegers, sure. People built them once in a while with discarded tech and cobbled-together armor. Jake could remember one in Serbia, and he thought he'd heard Lambert mention others in Uzbekistan and somewhere in South America, too. It was rare, but not unheard of. Oh, and there was also Scrapper. It was a lot smaller than your average Jaeger, but Amara had good instinct. She had built something impressive, considering the obstacles. Drifting with Amara had helped Jake understand her. A gearhead into all things with engines as a kid. But was that her, or was that because her dad was into that stuff and she did whatever he did? That was a question Jake had often asked himself about the Jaeger Corps. Had he gone into it because he believed in it, or because his father was Stacker Pentecost? He didn't have the answer right then, and maybe it didn't matter. However you got yourself into a place in life, you were there and had to deal with it as it was. Earlier that day, when he'd watched the drone presentation, Jake had been ready to walk away from the Jaeger service, but the whole Pan-Pacific Defense Corps in his rearview mirror. Then he'd felt the tug of the drift and realized how much it meant to him to be in a con pod again. And then came the fight against Obsidian Fury and Mako. He wasn't going to leave now. He'd come close, but it wasn't going to happen. This was as close as Jake Pentecost would ever get to believing in destiny. He was going to get back into Gypsy Avenger, and he was going to find Obsidian Fury and put that evil rogue down. The day was coming, soon, when he would see the pilots coming out of Obsidian Fury's con pod, defeated, and he would know he had begun to answer for Mako's death. Until then, he would look at the drawing his sister had left for him, and he would try to understand. 14. Memo. Private to Xiao Lian. Pursuant to your orders, we have undertaken off-hour surveillance of Dr. Newton Geisler and a general program of intelligence collection concerning his personal behaviors. Observations. Dr. Geisler frequently drinks to excess at bars near his apartment. The electricity bills at his apartment are much higher than any others in that building or others similar to it in the same district. None of his other expenses are notable apart from a large amount of money spent on expensive wines. He has not been observed to keep company with any other scientists or engineers employed by Xiao Industries competitors or with any Pan-Pacific Defense Corps personnel. He has not been observed to speak about his work with anyone in public, no matter the degree of his intoxication. He has not been observed in public with a romantic partner despite frequent overheard references to a woman named Alice. Her identity is unknown. Provisional conclusion. Dr. Geisler is not a security risk at this time, though continued surveillance is likely warranted and will continue. Kang. Newt knew that Xiao kept an eye on him when he wasn't at work. He didn't especially like it, but he saw why. She didn't like uncertainty or surprises, and she didn't understand Newt. He had lived his life skipping from flash of brilliance to flash of brilliance, suffering through the periods of stagnant frustration in between. She was another kind of genius, taking a particular kind of brilliance and ruthlessly applying it, like it was a kind of math she could use to solve the problem of life. She'd gotten rich, and after joining Xiao Industries, Newt had too. They sure paid a lot more than the PPDC. Newt didn't mind if she had him followed when he hit the bars or went out on the town. That was fine. She could disapprove, make disparaging comments to Chief Kang or whomever else. Newt didn't care. As long as he was in the lab making the drones better, Xiao would leave him alone. All this was running through Newt's mind when he walked into his lab at Xiao Industries late at night after the shocking attack of Obsidian Fury on the PPDC council building that day. It was too bad about Mako, he thought. He'd always liked her. He'd seen her develop from a shy, jumpy cadet to the Secretary General of the PPDC, keeping the flame of the old Rangers alive after the rest of them were all gone. Newt hadn't thought about it that way until just then, but Mako was the last of them. Only she and Raleigh had survived the breach, and Raleigh had been gone for... Well, Newt wasn't sure, but it was years. He'd been in a lab most of the time chasing the visions in his head. Some of those visions came from the time he and Herman had drifted with a kaiju brain. No point in denying it. Newt knew Herman felt that experience more keenly than he did, but Herman had never gotten out of the PPDC bubble, and he didn't have Newt's ability to leave things behind. Those had been good times, Newt thought. Him and Herman trying to save the world from the dumpy K-Science labs back when the survival of the human race depended on a couple of misfit rangers piloting a Jaeger that was already obsolete when it took the field against Otachi, let alone Skunner and Raiju. Names to conjure with. Newt carried them all in his head. He carried a lot in his head. Not all of it good. That was what still tied him to Herman after they had drifted with that kaiju brain back during the war. Newt was still thinking of this when he walked into his lab and saw Xiao Lian. What was she doing in his lab? At the moment, digging around in the fiber-optic guts of a drone Jaeger data core. She hadn't noticed him yet. Newt sidestepped toward one of the techs working on neural network stability in the drones. He couldn't remember her name. Dai... something. Dai Yu. That was it. He leaned in close, startling her, and asked, How long has she been here?
She stared up at him. Newt realized she didn't speak English. Mandarin was the lingua franca of Shao Industries.
Time, when?
He asked in Mandarin, nodding over at Shao.
Almost an hour, she said.
Newt crossed the lab toward Shao, cursing a blue streak under his breath the whole time. She was tinkering with a data core's interface, with Burke standing near her in a drone telemetry suit complete with a VR helmet rig that would let him operate the drone via its data core. It was kind of like drifting, only without the messy complications of interacting with another human mind.
"Hey, boss," he said, forcing himself to smile. "Sorry, thought you were still in Sydney."
She didn't return his greeting.
"The council has approved drone deployment in an emergency session,"
she said, getting right to the point, as usual. Obsidian Fury's missile barrage had apparently killed a number of the PPDC council members, leaving the rest of the group short of a quorum. Instead of naming new members, they had declared a temporary suspension of the quorum rules and approved the drone initiative before the fires in the council building had even been extinguished.
"Wow," Newt said. That's great."
Burke was giving him a funny look.
"Thought you'd be a little more enthusiastic, Doc," he said.
Newt knew Burke was one of the members of Shao's inner circle who didn't trust him.
"No, I am," he said. "It's just, you know, why they're approving now, because of the attack."
"I was there," Shao snapped at him. "I know what happened."
She went on in Mandarin. "And it wouldn't have if our drones had been in the field. Now everyone sees that."
"Yeah,"
Newt agreed. Something about her tone of voice made him unsure of himself.
"I guess they do."
"Which means the attack was positive, all things considered."
Ah, there it was. Shao the business tycoon, the drone evangelist, looking at the day's destruction and finding it good for business.
"If you look at it sideways and squint, then yeah," he said.
"I guess."
Shao was still dividing her attention between Newt and the data readouts from the core. She disconnected Burke from it and said,
"There's a 0.5 micro delay in the uplink to the data cores."
"I know, I'm working on boosting the connection. Any other irregularities I should know about?"
"No, all systems double thumbs."
He gave her two thumbs up. "Push your data to my server. I want to run a diagnostic. The council expects full deployment in 48 hours. Switching back to English so Burke and the other non-Chinese there could see her ordering Newt around, she added, "Get it done." Then with Burke at her side, she swept out of the lab. Newt called after her.
"Sure, no problem. I'm on it like a..."
For some reason, words failed him.
"Like a guy that's really, really on it."
Words never failed him. He felt unsettled by this. He was slipping gears once in a while, but also doing some of the best, most amazing work he'd ever done. Even so, getting the drones online, tested and deployed in 48 hours was a tall order. The tech crew appeared stunned by Shao's ultimatum.
"What?"
Dayu looked aghast.
"No way we'll be ready."
"Way? Way? Yes, way,"
Newt said. He had to make this happen or he would be out of a job and the consequences of that.
"Know what? You're fired,"
he said, trying to put a little fear of God into the text to get them moving. Then he immediately reconsidered. He needed Dayu. She was too smart to fire right then.
"No, get this done, then you're fired. Or promoted. We'll see how it goes. But probably fired. Go, shoo."
The techs scattered to their workstations. Holoscreens blinked into existence all over the lab as they feverishly ran testing simulations and revised code. Newt strolled among them, letting them know he was watching, and then he came to the large observation window that looked out over the factory floor. Row after row of drone Jaegers stood on the floor with automated machinery making final adjustments to their external components. Other factory robots were fitting each drone with data cores. Could they be done in 48 hours? Despite his promise to Shao, Newt wasn't sure. He took another look at the techs, wondering if he'd taken the right tack. He wasn't ordinarily a high-pressure, threatening kind of guy. He preferred to glad-hand, make people feel good, impress them with his savvy, and make them feel like he was the kind of boss who deserved their best effort. But he was under a lot of pressure, and desperate times, as the saying went, called for desperate measures. 15. Status report on cadet class, Moyle in Shatterdome, Ranger Nathan Lambert. The current cadet class has made satisfactory progress toward drift fluency and Jaeger technical understanding. Interpersonal rivalries and personality clashes are within expected ranges. Current provisional backup assignments to Moylan's Jaeger detail would be Ilya, Bracer Phoenix, Jinhai, Valor Omega, Maylin, Gypsy Avenger, Renata, Saber Athena, Ryuichi, Saber Athena, Suresh, Guardian Bravo, Tahima, Titan Redeemer, Victoria, Valor Omega. Update. The late addition of Cadet Amara Namani has destabilized the equilibrium of the class. Her skills are still being assessed, but this writer questions her overall fitness for the program due to her background and lack of discipline. Assignment to a Jaeger would be premature. The cadets were clustered around a stored news feed of the Sydney attack, swiping back and forth through Obsidian Fury's battle with Gypsy Avenger. Amara held the datapad, mesmerized by the rogue Jaeger. Had someone really built that? She knew how hard it was to design and make something even the scale of Scrapper. How had someone found the resources to do this without the PPDC noticing? They kept track of the international trade and technologies used in the creation of Jaeger systems. Drift tech was strictly controlled. Had someone invented it independently? Or was there a mole in Shao Industries or one of the other companies that manufactured Jaeger parts? However it had happened, Obsidian Fury was an impressive piece of work. Tahima, leaning over her shoulder, snorted. Obsidian Fury doesn't even sound like a real Jaeger name.
I don't think Tahima sounds like a real name, Renata shot back. But your mama did.
Amara ignored the sniping. It was all part of the cadet game, the way they established their pecking order. She didn't want to be part of it.
There's never been a rogue like this. How'd the kaiju nuts build it? Ones where I'm from couldn't change a battery without getting fried.
Maybe they stole it, Ryuichi suggested.
Da, Ilya agreed. You can steal anything in my country with overalls and work order.
These pilots, they're too fast. I don't understand how they're exceeding the neural load.
Ballerinas, Jinhai said for maybe the 100th time that day. I'm telling you.
For some reason, this idea drove Tahima crazy.
Shut up with that crap, man. You know how many people died in Sydney?
He acted like it was an insult to them that Jaeger pilots might have ballet training. But to Amara, it made sense. Learning that kind of balance and grace couldn't help but be an asset in a fight.
Newsfeed said they're posting a dozen Jaegers at the memorial,
Maylin said. A dozen Jaegers. That was a real make of how much respect Makamori had commanded.
When I die, I want that many to send me off, Suresh said. Your pop's gonna make you work with boobs when you wash out, Renata said.
Jaegers do not show up when the boob guy dies,
Ilya observed.
Your dad works with boobs?
Amara had never heard this.
He's a plastic surgeon, Suresh explained, exasperated. He doesn't just work with...
He caught himself, realizing he was wasting his breath.
And I'm not washing out. I'm going to be a pilot.
Still, Jinhai said.
You die? Eh. I'd post one Jaeger at your funeral, maybe half a Jaeger.
I heard that's where they found Amara, Vic said. In half a Jaeger.
Amara dropped the datapad on her bunk and stood up. She wasn't going to stand there and be insulted when she was the only one in the room who'd ever done anything like build Scrapper.
It was a whole Jaeger. It just wasn't very big, Victoria.
The other cadets got quiet when they heard Amara use Vic's full name. That was a challenge, and all of them knew it. Vic stepped up to Amara, looming over her. She was used to scaring people with her size and strength.
Bigger is better, she said.
Amara sized her up. She was starting to reconsider her strategy of escalating the confrontation. It was one thing to stand up for yourself, another to get your ass kicked for no reason.
Look,
Amara paused, trying to remember what she'd learned from Jinhai the day before.
Idi na fig.
Ilya's head snapped up. He was the other Russian speaker in the group, and his reaction told Amara she hadn't said exactly what she meant to say. Vic laughed out loud in disbelief.
What did you say?
Amara tried again.
Idi na fig?
She looked over at Jinhai.
Am I saying that right?
Jinhai, clearly trying not to laugh, nodded and said,
Yup.
Amara had just figured out that Jinhai had pranked her when Vic lunged forward and grabbed her in a chokehold. Amara struggled, but Vic was much bigger and much stronger. She couldn't break free.
Whoa,
Jinhai said. Ryuichi tried to break them up.
Vic, come on, let her go.
I worked every day of my life to be here. You didn't do anything. You were just picked up off the street like garbage.
Vic snarled, squeezing harder. The insult snapped something inside Amara. With strength she had known she possessed, she broke free of the chokehold. But she didn't try to get away from Vic. Instead, she used Vic as a pivot point, scissoring her legs up and around Vic's neck. The counterattack knocked Vic off balance and she went down, with Amara now in control.
"Know where I learned that?" Mara hissed. "On the street, you big dumb—"
"Namani, Malakova."
Every one of the cadets, even Vic thrashing against Amara's scissor hold, looked over at the barracks door to see Nate Lambert.
"Ranger on deck!"
Ryoichi shouted. All of them except Amara and Vic snapped to attention. Amara let Vic go and scrambled to her feet.
"She jumped me."
Now Vic was on her feet too.
"She does not belong here."
"Enough!"
Lambert snapped. He glared at both of the combatants, daring them to say another word. Neither of them did. Amara could tell he wasn't just angry. The day's events had wounded him, and he was not in the mood to deal with dumb status fights among his cadets. He let them stand at attention for a long moment before he started speaking. They were expecting an angry dressing down, but instead Lambert's voice was quiet and level.
"When I first joined the Corps, I was just like you," he said. "Worse, even. I was nobody, from nowhere, but Makomori told me I could make a difference."
Over Lambert's shoulder, Amara saw Jake drifting in from the hall. He'd probably heard the scrap just like Lambert had, and come to see what was going on. Lambert kept talking, his voice tight with emotion that he was trying hard to control.
"She said, whoever you are, wherever you come from, the minute you enter this program, you're part of a family. And the people beside you are your brothers and sisters."
He had noticed Jake by now, and Amara thought this part of the speech was directed at Jake as much as at the cadets.
"No matter what they do, no matter how stupid they act, you forgive, and you move on, because that's what family does. Start believing that out here, and you'll start believing it in a Jaeger."
Amara was normally immune to inspirational speeches, but this one resonated. Family. She didn't have one anymore. Everyone in the room, cadet or ranger, had lost someone. That loss bound them together into a new kind of family, even if some of the other members were assholes sometimes. She caught Vic's eye and saw Vic was understanding the same thing. Sheepish at the way they goaded each other, they exchanged a nod. And by the doorway, Amara could see Jake Pentecost thinking along the same lines. She didn't know exactly what had happened between them, but she knew Jake had quit, and she knew he and Lambert had been partners. Hearing Lambert's speech and seeing Jake's reaction, Amara started to put two and two together. Lambert was forgiving him. He was walking the walk, doing himself what he demanded of the cadets. Amara had spent her whole life trying not to feel anything, but she'd never been around a group like this. In that moment, she would have died for all of them. This was her family now. Jules, the JTEC beauty that both Jake and Lambert were after, stuck her head into the room.
"Hey."
When Jake and Lambert turned toward her, she said,
"Marshall's looking for you guys. Says Gottlieb found something."
Back in the K-Science lab, Jake stood with Lambert and Quan as Gottlieb swiped away a number of programs he'd had running and exposed Mako's kaiju head drawing.
"It isn't something," he said. "It's somewhere."
He worked a holoscreen, moving Mako's drawing over a section of a satellite map. The outline of the head matched the topography perfectly. Jake drew in a breath. She had been sending a message, staring death in the face. Mako had kept the presence of mind to make sure that this knowledge wouldn't die with her.
"Severnaya Zemlya," Gottlieb said, "off Siberia's Taimyr Peninsula."
Next to the overlay of the drawing and the map, a larger-scale map appeared, showing the whole peninsula and the scattering of islands reaching north from it into the Arctic Ocean.
"What's there?" Quan asked. "Nothing anymore," Gottlieb said.
He zoomed the map in, focusing on the area under the eye of Mako's drawing.
"A facility roughly in this location was used to manufacture Jaeger power cores early in the war, but it was decommissioned years ago."
"Why would Mako be trying to tell us about an abandoned factory in the middle of nowhere?" Lambert wondered. He was eyeing Jake as he said it, and Jake could read between the lines easily enough. He was making Jake an offer, challenging him, if they really wanted to find out what Mako had been trying to tell them.
Jake turned to Marshal Kwan. Sir, permission to take Gypsy Avenger and see what the hell's out there. Kwan considered, but not for long. 16. PBDC Facilities Division, Severn Naya Manufacturing Facility. Constructed, June 2019. Production, power cores and plasma capacitors, Mark II and Mark III Jaegers, cabling and conduit insulation, reactor housings. Staffing, 267. Decommissioned, December 2022. Reason for decommissioning. Remoteness of location offered protection from kaiju attacks, but caused difficulties in shipping. Personnel suffered from low morale and resultant low productivity as a result of isolation. Shipments were vulnerable to theft due to multiple transfer points en route to Shatterdome locations. Errors in sighting survey resulted in nearby glaciers causing shifts in subterranean areas of the manufacturing floor. Method of disposal. Attempts to sell or lease the facility to PPDC industrial and manufacturing partners were unsuccessful. Personnel reassignment to Anchorage and Vladivostok, December 2022. Critical machinery removed February 2023. Facility abandoned March 2023. No current monitoring or plans for reuse. From Moylan to the Tamer Peninsula was a long trip via jump ox. Gypsy Avenger, with Jake and Lambert holding their drift, arrived 36 hours after Gottlieb's revelation, dropping from the jump ox down through a blizzard to the frozen ground of Siberia. The PPDC had built a number of factories in places like this, far from the Pacific Ocean and therefore less likely to be lost in kaiju attacks. But this one had been mothballed during the war, according to the records Gottlieb had retrieved. Newer power core technologies pioneered in China and Washington State had relocated much of the manufacturing to those places, and the Severn Naya facility had been completely abandoned for more than a decade. They got visual contact on the factory from a distance of a few hundred yards, right at the limit of visibility given the weather. It had been built into the side of a mountain, and since its abandonment, a glacier had overspread part of the complex. Cascading ice had almost obscured it, and what they could see looked dilapidated and partially collapsed. Lambert had Gypsy doing full-spectrum tactical scans of the complex, and he wasn't finding anything. No life signs. Looks like Gottlieb was right. Place is abandoned. The scanner chirped, and Jake saw a signal of some kind on the readout in front of him. It was tuned to different energy signatures than Lambert's, and until that moment it hadn't shown anything either. Jake looked more closely. Wait a second. The signal was faint. Fluctuating. The scanning package couldn't identify it. I'm picking up some weird readings, Jake said. Lambert leaned over to look at Jake's scanner. Neither of them could make sense of what they were seeing. Both of them were so focused on interpreting the scanner's readings that they missed an alarm from Gypsy's defensive sensor package. When the first volley of plasma missiles streaked past them, they jumped, instinctively flinching away from the paths of the missiles. But they weren't the target. The missiles exploded across the wall of the factory, destroying it and bringing down the whole face of ice and rock. Whatever evidence the factory might have contained, it was blasted to atoms now and buried under a million tons of mountain. Gypsy spun around to see Obsidian Fury looming out of the blizzard. With a snarl, Jake leaned forward in his drift cradle, pushing Gypsy Avenger into a charge. The last time he'd seen Obsidian Fury, he'd been scared, uncertain, still wondering if he'd done the right thing getting back into a Jaeger. Now he was feeling only one thing, the overwhelming vengeful need to beat Obsidian Fury into the ground and find out who was inside. Maka was going to have justice. Obsidian Fury slowed Gypsy down with a missile barrage, but they kept charging. Alarms sounded in the con pod, cataloging damage to Gypsy's systems. Get him off his feet! Lambert shouted. Jake roared a battle cry and sprang up in the drift cradle. Gypsy Avenger leaped forward, tackling Obsidian Fury and skidding across the ice. Still locked together, the two Jaegers slid over the edge of a crevasse. In the fall, they separated. Gypsy unleashed her chain sword, and Obsidian Fury answered with its twin plasma saws. They struck at each other as they slid and bounced down the steep bed of the crevasse, neither landing a damaging blow in the confined environment. First Obsidian Fury and then Gypsy Avenger smashed through a wall of ice at the bottom of the crevasse, tumbling through onto a large ice floe in the shallows off the coast. The floe rocked as Obsidian Fury got to its feet.
The deep orange light in its chest emplacement glowed suddenly brighter, and Gypsy Avenger barely got her chainsword up in time to deflect the blast of Obsidian Fury's particle beam. The sword scattered the beam's force in ribbons of energy that flared between them and brought bursts of steam from the ice flow.
"Systems are overloading!"